the details of General Sir Peter Cosgrove, I'll get that right, coming to Maitland. Look Who's Talking. It's the program that they run there at Maitland Library. A conversational interview as part of Maitland Library's popular Look Who's Talking program next Thursday, 6 p.m. start, Reading Cinema, Charlestown. Tickets, well, and also too, the books will be available, and no doubt you'll be able to have a chat with General Sir Peter Cosgrove and get your copy of the book signed. But for more information and to book a seat, if you visit the website Maitland Library, that's one word, maitlandlibrary.com.au, and just look for the events of Peter Cosgrove in conversation. We caught up with the man yesterday, and look, I'll say at the outset, he did say, please call me Peter. So we weren't being disrespectful when you hear us calling him Peter, but we did catch up yesterday morning after we came off air, hence we're airing it today, with the man himself, General Sir Peter Cosgrove.
Well, Richard and Kim, good morning to you both.
And a very good morning to you. Congratulations on the book. This is your second, and I must ask you first up, a terrific photo on the cover. Was there a bit of a family discussion before you decided on what photo would go on the cover of this new book, Peter?
Very briefly, because my wife endorses the fact that this is actually the shot that we think tells the story. Basically, it, I hope, reflects on the theme of the book, which is that you're in service, you're doing your best, but you can find good humour, goodwill at every turn. And that's what was basically the outcome of that photo. I'm very pleased the publishers and I agreed so readily that this was the shot.
And I believe that was the last occasion in which you wore that that full dress uniform, is that correct?
Last time I've had a uniform on, that was in the middle of the year in 2019 at a parade at Duntroon. That's a sort of a winter style uniform. You'll notice all the cadets are in a similar uniform, except of course the old bloke, which is me, I've got all the stuff on me because I've been around a long time.
A bling fan.
You're
in the cadets at school. I might add, too, I was a Barker boy, another one of the associated schools, and I remember even back then there was the Catholics versus, we were Barkers being good Anglicans. It was the Catholics versus the Anglicans back then. Look, you served in cadets. You went to Duntroon Military College. When exactly did and why did you decide to become a professional soldier?
Well, I came out of a military family, which where the role models, the males, had been my granddad, who lived with us, World War One, service between the wars in the military, and then World War Two in the AIF, and he was now retired and working, I think, in the taxation office here in Sydney. Anyway, he was a role model. He and my father joined the military before World War Two. He was in the Coastal Artillery. He was in the AIF during the war, and he was still in the Army. So I came out of a military household.
Now, speaking of family, I read with interest in the chapter Marriage, Family and Moves. You've had a couple of stints in our neck of the world. In fact, your first posting up at Singleton was when you had, quote, a highway romance with your now wife, Lynn. Tell us about that and the proposal. Yep.
Oh, well, look, Kim, Lynn and I had been dating when I was still in Sydney in the 70s. I had 3 years out of Holsworthy, and in the last year of that, she and I started to go out, went out on a blind date and started to date exclusively after that. And at the end of that third year in Holsworthy, I was posted to Singleton, but by then we were going steady. So I was obviously intent on keeping the relationship going by travelling up and down the highway. One evening in Singleton, when all the other officers in the officers' mess and their wives were attending this lovely function, it was quite romantic. You know, everybody was in candlelight dinner, I think we call them. And I was looking around and I thought, why am I mucking around? So I went outside, jumped into a phone box and rang my now wife, and proposed to her over the phone. It wasn't all that romantic to propose over the phone, except for the operators. In those days, the Hunter Valley and lots of other places had a manual exchange, and there were ladies who worked there as telephonists, and they'd connect you up when you might wanted a trunk call. So this is what happened. and I ran out of coins while I was still in mid-proposal. so a lady came on and said, you know, you got more coins sort of thing. I said, no, I haven't got any more coins, but I'm proposing to my girlfriend. And she went, oh. And, you know, I spoke unlimited after that. But I think they were all listening in.
Oh, great story.
You talk about the effect that being awarded the Military Cross had on you, and you talk about the halo effect. Would you mind just explaining the halo effect?
Well, yeah, look, when you get something notable of that nature happen to you, it sort of places you automatically up on a bit of a pedestal, because you, in the military, this sort of symbology is quite apparent. You wear a special coloured ribbon on your a campaign ribbon or award ribbon on your chest, and it's very evident. Everybody knows what they're looking at. So there's the pedestal. You're up on it. And from that point, people start to judge you to a higher standard. And you're very well aware of that. So you start striving hard to be at the higher standard. You don't want to let the side down and not perform to the automatic expectations that this sort of halo effect that I'm talking about creates. So it just drives you on a bit. And once you've started to perform at the higher level, well, now you must continue. You don't sort of do that spasmodically. You try to do it in an enduring way.
Well, that is recognition within the military. In your chapter, Pole Vaulting into the Spotlight, you talk about being widely recognised then by the public. You know, we're talking about East Timor, and I think that was the first time we everyone knew your name, what you looked like, and what our troops were doing over there. I just wondered, given the situation, and this probably applies to other aspects of your life and what you do, either in war or peacekeeping or, you know, rebuilding after Cyclone Larry, is it possible for you to establish long-lasting friendships in that environment?
Yeah, well, look, there's two sides to any person in the public arena. There's the side everybody sees. Hopefully that's an authentic side, not just something concocted or confected for the moment. But then you've got your mates, and with them you can relax. You can say things to your friends, and they will respect the friendship and the confidence. And hopefully they're pretty close to one another. I mean, obviously, I don't walk around in public stopping strangers to say, I'll tell you a joke, two horses walk into a bar. You know, you don't do that. You're a bit more serious than that. But with your pals, if you've heard the latest two horses walk into a bar joke, then you'll trot it out and they'll say, ha ha, heard it last week, you know, that sort of stuff. So you have a more natural and spontaneous reaction with your mates. So hopefully the two personas are very close. I feel they are.
Right.
I try to be of goodwill and pretty exuberant with just about everybody I meet.
The spotlight's certainly been shining on politics in the United States in recent times. In your time as Governor General, you and your wife, Lynn, attended or hosted, I think it was about 4,200 events. Obviously, not all of them memorable, but you talk about the funeral of George Bush as being a bit of an eye-opener for you, Peter.
First time I'd seen what you might call pinnacle United States protocol and ceremonial. So the funeral of a much respected former president was that just such an occasion. And it was done in a giant cathedral, the National Cathedral in Washington. I'm guessing at the capacity, a couple of thousand at least. And they're all in there. Congress, yeah. I mean, a lot of the House of Representatives and the Senate were in there milling around. So, and all the former presidents that were accessible. I'm sure, I think they were all the living ex-presidents, former presidents were there, plus President Trump and Melania. So, you know, it was that sort of day, and it was quite impressive.
The behaviour of a number of SAS personnel serving in Afghanistan has obviously been highlighted by the Brereton Inquiry, the redacted report being made public today. Obviously, we're not going to talk about the details, but you talk in the book about, well, I think you refer to as the hazard of keeping a small group of soldiers repeatedly going back into combat and the negative effect that can have, not only on the soldiers, but those around them and particularly families and loved ones.
Yeah, look, I cling to that as a as at least a factor. I have to be plain, as well as saying that, and I do believe that there is a hazard, a danger in repeated tours of duty of that nature. But there is an absolute line as well. So it should not be thought that, oh, because they went back a lot of times and then somehow that sort of dissolves guilt. If there's guilt or accountability coming out of the Brereton inquiry, then there will be further investigations to establish whether there should be prosecutions. And if people have crossed that line, then they must be accountable. So there's no doubt about that. And it is so sad in so many respects, because the Australian people need to have affection and respect and trust in their military sons and daughters who are in uniform. And that is the case, but it's let down from time to time when events like this start to emerge.
Certainly, and you know, I'm sure we'll see the result of that in the coming weeks. Now, Peter, you are coming up to, well, Maitland next week on the 26th. You'll be at Reddings in Maitland. But you spent 2 years up here at Williamtown. Do you come up here very often? Have you noticed the massive changes in our neck of the woods?
Yeah, I have. It's wonderful. It's a I'm sort of an honorary citizen of the Hunter Valley. In fact, I was made a free man of the Shire of Singleton because I had two postings there. One was my first posting married to Lynn, and then I went back as the commandant of the base up there in the early 90s, and I enjoyed those immensely. So 95, 96, I'm at Williamtown, so I enjoyed that immensely. Love the place. So we'll be back up there to do book things and also things to do with the various charities that rugby gets behind. And I'm going to very intent on seeing lots of people I know while I'm up there. So
good.
The only thing is I can't stay up there for the test.
Oh, well, I was about to ask you. You played the game. You've been on the board of the Australian Rugby Union. We have a wonderful stadium here. Do you think the Wallabies can beat Argentina here on Saturday night in Newcastle, Peter?
Well, I would have said we have a good track record against the Pumas, the Argentinians, from previous games. But after they played that magnificent game against the All Blacks, I'd have to say we'll need to be on our toes if we want to sneak a win. They are a very impressive team, the Pumas.
Yes. Thank you very much for your time this morning. Congratulations on the book, and enjoy the visit to Maitland next week, Peter.
Thank you very much for your time, and Richard and Kim, lovely to talk to you.
Lovely to talk to General Sir Peter Cosgrave. We spoke to him yesterday after we came off air. He will be in Maitland, Reading Cinemas at Maitland, next Thursday, 6 o'clock, a conversational interview with Scott Bevan. It's a ticketed event, obviously limited seating. If you'd like more information and to book a seat, go to the Maitland Library website. It's Maitland Library, one word, maitlandlibrary.com.au. And you'll find the link to Peter Cosgrave in conversation.